Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. We're taking health issues to mind during this next hour and a half as we begin the show by talking with you about Huntington's and Parkinson's diseases today with our guest, Dr. Kathleen Shannon, with us. She is in the studio with me, a professor and chair of neurology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Her medical interests include movement disorders, especially neurodegenerative disorders such as Huntington's and Parkinson's disease. So we'll be taking a look at some promising new treatments and, of course, take your questions and comments as well as we move along. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Dr. Kathleen Shannon, welcome. Thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Larry.
Well, Huntington's and Parkinson's are neurodegenerative diseases. That's a mouthful. What does that mean?
A neurodegenerative disease is one that's characterized by progressive loss of brain cells. And there are a bunch of neurodegenerative diseases, and what separates one from the other is which brain cells. So Alzheimer's disease, the most common one, is characterized by progressive loss of brain cells in the memory systems. Parkinson's and Huntington's involve the motor systems, movement control, but also thinking, memory, behavior, mood, etc.
Yeah. So what are the symptoms of, let's take Parkinson's first here. What are the symptoms of Parkinson's?
There are four main symptoms that all involve movement. And one is, the most important one is bradykinesia, which is just a fancy way of saying slow movement. So a delay in initiating movements, small amplitude movements, and slowness of the movement itself. A common one that's more commonly known but not quite as important is tremor, especially tremor when the hand is at rest or the leg is at rest. The third one is rigidity, which is something we feel in the muscles when we move the limbs around. And the fourth one is postural instability, which is difficulty maintaining the upright posture when there's a threat to it. So if you get bumped or pushed, for example.
Oh, boy. So diagnosing something like that, difficult?
Difficult because it's a clinical diagnosis, so there's no blood test or brain scan, which means the person who's listening to the patient history, and that's really the most important part of our job, is listening to the patient, and then doing the examination has to be very alert to that group of features all occurring together to make the diagnosis.
And just in terms of prognosis for Parkinson's, what kind of life expectancy and so forth do we have?
The typical patient develops the symptoms and gets diagnosed around the age of 60 or early 60s, and the average age of death is 84. So this is a long process. But over that time, there's a kind of steady downhill progression. Now, Parkinson's disease is a manageable disease because we have medicines that help to make people more mobile. And it's really the loss of mobility that threatens lifespan. If you can't walk, really, you're prone to lots of infections and complications. So if we keep people walking, we can get them a nice, long, better quality of life over those 20-some years.
So let's talk, skip to Huntington's for a minute. How is it different from Parkinson's disease?
Huntington's disease is a genetic condition, so there's one gene that's abnormal, and if you have a parent with Huntington's disease, you have a 50-50 chance of inheriting that gene and of developing the disease. So it's quite different in the sense that everyone gets it for the same reason, which is a great advantage to us because that disease then can be modeled in animals and you can screen drug compounds, and a treatment that helps one Huntington's patient should help all Huntington's patients.
Well, that's good. And if both parents have it's in the gene, are you going to get it for sure?
If both parents have it, because it's a dominantly inherited condition, 75% of their children will be affected. That's a very unusual thing. I've never seen that myself. But in Venezuela, where the gene was discovered, there's a very large group of patients who all descended from the same ancestor. Yeah. And so there are lots of cases where a Huntington's person married another person with Huntington's and had children with two copies of the abnormal gene. But I've never seen that here in 30 years of work.
I saw a fascinating piece on 60 Minutes about that Venezuelan doctor who, I think it was the Catholic Church that had came up with the families and so forth, and actually did a a model of all of the families and came up with some very valuable information in terms of working with folks with Huntington's.
Yes, it's been an extremely important population, and there was a group of researchers that went there every year for a time, but Venezuela's gotten so unstable that there's really no active research happening there anymore.
That's kind of too bad. How does it progress?
So Huntington's disease can start really in infancy all the way up until old age, so the age of onset's quite a bit more variable. But it usually starts around the age of 35. And it, like Parkinson's disease, is about a 20-year illness. It's just that we don't have very good treatments to improve the mobility and function in our patients. So they have quite a bit of disability, quite a bit more disability, and quite a bit more impact on quality of life. And since they get it earlier, they die earlier. So these people usually die in their 60s.
Yeah, that's what I was just running that through my head. I guess if you have your choice between the two, who would want to have that choice anyway, but probably Parkinson's is maybe a better disease along for that reason.
Yeah, so if we could pick our genes and our environmental exposures, then maybe that would be possible. But certainly we have a lot more ability to improve quality of life in Parkinson's disease than in Huntington's disease.
And again, how does it progress?
So Huntington's disease is a motor disorder. So the early motor signs are fidgety or twisty movements called chorea. But ultimately, Huntington's patients develop a more global mobility change, so they become unable to walk and communicate and swallow their food, and so they have a really severe disability. And since we don't have medicines that improve that disability, patients are very sick for a very long time. But in addition to the mobility aspects, there's a very prominent cognitive picture. Lots of problems with problem solving and learning and organizing, something we call executive dysfunction, and then progressing to a state of really severe dementia. And then the third part is there are a lot of behavioral changes, so impulsiveness and irritability and depression, et cetera. So it's a much more severe condition in the sense that it involves many more aspects of human function. We don't have good ways to improve most of those aspects of human function. And it's at a time in your life when you ordinarily are very busy raising your family and working your career. So, and then there's also the burden that your children may get sick as well. So it's a much more global kind of impact on our patients' lives.
And it sounds a little more like Alzheimer's to me, the later stages at least.
Well, and Parkinson's disease, too, has a lot of problems with thinking and memory that occur later in the disease. But in Huntington's disease, those things occur early, so that a Huntington's patient can only work a few years after diagnosis, if that, whereas the average Parkinson's patient works 10 years after diagnosis. So there's a big difference on the economic impact between the two diseases as well.
Talking with Dr. Kathleen Shannon today about Huntington's and Parkinson's diseases, and certainly inviting your questions. We have some callers online. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Barbara in Appleton's been waiting a bit, so let's go to Barbara. Hi, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
My husband was diagnosed with PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy, 2 years ago. He's 72 years old now. And the symptoms are, they call it a Parkinsonian-like disease. And from what you were just describing, I don't know what difference there is between Parkinson's and PSP, other than he does not have the tremors. And I would just like you to kind of
comment, sure.
Discuss that. Yeah, it seems to be so rare. Nobody's ever heard of it, whereas they've heard so much about Parkinson's.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for calling. And I'm sorry your husband is afflicted with this, Barbara. Dr. Shannon, can you comment?
Progressive supranuclear palsy is, in fact, very rare, as you said, Barbara. And it's considered a variant of Parkinson's, but it's quite a different disease. So in addition to your observation that patients with progressive supranuclear palsy, or PSP, we call it, don't have tremor, is a correct one. They tend to have a very symmetrical mobility issue, often with falls in the first year, so lots of gait impairment. And they have a very characteristic change where they have difficulty moving their eyes up and down, especially down, and a more rapidly progressive dementia. And the progression rate is faster. And there's a lot more impact of their immobility because we don't have good medicines to improve it.
Mm.
So I don't know if that's kind of your experience with your husband, Barbara, but that's kind of the typical presentation and progression rate of PSP.
Yeah, the eyesight thing is what seems to be the worst. It seems to affect just about everything.
And patients with PSP often also have very impulsive behavior, so they'll do kind of dangerous things like jump out of the chair and fall down, those kinds of things. I don't know if your husband does that. So there's that additional kind of worry for most of our spouses who take care of PSP patients.
Yeah,
he doesn't do that, but... the life expectancy for people with this, I've heard, is 5 to 7 years after diagnosis.
Yeah, so usually by 5 to 7 years, people are wheelchair-bound, and when a person is wheelchair-bound, then their life expectancy shortens really considerably.
Yeah, quickly.
So I would say between 5 and 10 years is the average survival.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Again, I'm sorry for your... for the issues that your husband has. Well, let's take another call. Bethany in Madison up next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, what's on your mind?
Well, I have a question. My dad has Parkinson's, and he's had it for 20 years about now, and he... he's been trying to remain very active, which I think has really helped him so much, like, delay the onset of different symptoms. But lately now, he is extremely fatigued to the point where, he's sleeping a lot of the day. And I feel like if he were up and awake more often, he could continue to do all the exercises and continue to move and do stuff around the house. But with his fatigue, I'm concerned about, just progressively getting worse. So I don't know if she has any suggestions or what might help with that.
Okay.
So that's my one question. Then my other question is, it seems like so many people I know have Parkinson's. And is it on the rise? Is there, is it better diagnosis, or what might be going on with that?
All right. Good questions. Thank you so much for calling, Bethany.
So let me answer the second question first. Because the population is aging, we're expecting roughly a doubling of the number of people with Parkinson's disease between now and 2040. And this is true. This will be true of Alzheimer's disease and all the other changes of aging. And, of course, I think that diagnosis is better as awareness has increased and a lot of the public is generally aware of what Parkinson's disease looks like. So that's, I think, an affirmation of what you're noticing, that everyone seems to have Parkinson's. It's the second most common neurodegenerative disease after Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. Regarding fatigue is a poorly understood symptom, but it's almost universal. It's the number one complaint of early Parkinson's disease. And there are lots of sleep problems and sleep complaints in Parkinson's disease, so that our patients tend to not have very restorative sleep at night, and then they also tend to be excessively sleepy during the day. What you're observing, that he just kind of will fall asleep and sleep a lot during the day, is very frustrating and very common. Sometimes we use stimulant medicines, something that you might use in a hyperactivity disorder, for example, but those you have to be very careful with. And keeping people engaged and kind of on their feet more is a good way to help people feel less fatigued. And then there are various things we can try to make sure that the sleep at night is more restorative.
And there's a new study, I think, that showed that exercise may help symptoms of the disease, kind of going along with what she was talking about with her father, who was kept an active lifestyle.
Yes, that's an extremely important point. There are a number of studies of exercise in Parkinson's disease, and people will ask me, what's the best exercise? And the answer is that everything that's been studied is good. So treadmill, walking, bicycle riding, tango dancing, tai chi, virtually every kind of movement is helpful in Parkinson's disease, and the magnitude of those benefits is pretty good. It's about as good as adding a medicine to the medication regimen. We have good kind of basic science reasons to think that exercise might protect the brain cells from degeneration, but we haven't been able to prove that yet in people. But the way we kind of think about this is that exercise strengthens the connections between brain cells, and more connected brain cells seem to be more protected from degeneration. So I'm very enthusiastic about exercise and really exhort all my patients to be as physically active as possible.
Oh, interesting. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Kathleen Shannon, our guest today, professor and chair of neurology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll be talking to an emergency room doctor about how to prepare at home for medical emergencies. So stay with us for that. Right now, though, we're taking a look at Huntington's and Parkinson's diseases and some medical advances. We've gotten into that a little bit, but certainly looking forward to hearing from you. If you have a relative, a friend with Huntington's or Parkinson's disease, questions about it, I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Love to hear from you. A listener emailed to ask if you could talk about stiff person syndrome. I don't know that language, so.
Stiff person syndrome is also a movement disorder, but not really a degenerative disorder. It's more of an immune-mediated disorder that attacks certain nerve cells in the spinal cord that control the excitability of nerve and muscle. And so people with stiff person syndrome have pain and have their muscles never relax. So it's a very rare condition. We don't see very much of it. I might see a case a year or something. But there are good treatments for it, actually, both to reduce the excitability of those nerves and also to change the kind of dynamic of the immune system attack on the nerve cells.
And are those fairly well known across the medical community, or are...
Well, one problem with rare diseases is it's hard to find someone who's treated more than a handful of cases.
Yeah.
But, you know, the medical literature is very useful and helpful. And then one advantage to having super specialized people is that you can, if your provider isn't comfortable with it, they can always pick up the phone and give us a call for advice or send a person for a consultation to get some advice on how to manage things over the long term.
Okay. Well, Penny in Green Bay has something for us, so let's go there next. Hi, Penny. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Larry and Dr. Shannon. This is a great show. I'm calling particularly about the medications that are used to treat Parkinson's, dopamine, and what kind of dosage that should be and what side effects and the long-term impact, because I understand that dopamine can have some pretty unusual and difficult side effects.
Thank you for calling, Penny. Dr. Shannon?
That's a great question. So those four features that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the slowness and the stiffness and the problems with walking and balance and the tremor, are all related to the brunt of the degenerative process affecting the brain cells that manufacture the chemical dopamine. And dopamine is a very important chemical that's important for not only movement, but also mood and motivation. And so the mainstay of treating the mobility concerns of Parkinson's are to increase the amount of dopamine in the nervous system. And the most effective medicine is called levodopa. It's been around, if you saw the movie Awakenings with Robin Williams.
Yeah.
It's kind of referred to the first treatments of a certain population with levodopa. And it's extremely effective medicine. But what happens over time is that two things. One is the disease evolves to involve other chemical systems. And so certain symptoms will not respond. but also the way the brain responds to the dopamine for the movement symptoms will change over time or evolve. And so people need to take their medicines more frequently, sometimes at a higher dose. They often will need other medications that affect how the levodopa is handled by the body in order to try to smooth out the mobility. And so I think what we're talking about here is that there's not the same dose that's effective for every person. And a dose that's effective for one person at one time will need to be adjusted over time to address these kinds of evolutions in the response to the medicine. So the medicine becomes more short-acting, so you need to take it more often. And the medicine causes something called dyskinesia, which are twisty or fidgety movements. If you see Michael J. Fox, who's had Parkinson's a long time, what you see in him is not slowness or tremor. You see side effects of medicine, kind of a fidgetiness. And then also many patients over the course of a disease will at one time or another have hallucinations related to Parkinson's disease medications. And that's mainly because we can't send all the dopamine to the area of the brain that's deficient in dopamine. Oh. And in areas that already have enough dopamine, too much dopamine causes hallucinations. So it's complicated.
Yeah.
And the more knowledgeable the provider is in understanding how the medicine works and what the side effects are, the better the patient will do. And there's good data now that patients who are treated by neurologists who have more education in Parkinson's disease have a much better outcome, fewer hospitalizations, fewer hip fractures, fewer complications of therapy. So especially when a person is kind of in the more advanced stages, it helps to have a neurologist working with the primary care doctor fairly closely to make sure that the medicines are adjusted in the optimum way for the individual patient.
And at UW hospitals and clinics, of course, you chair the Department of Neurology, so quite a staff of people who are interested in it.
Right. We have a team. So we have five healthcare physicians, neurologists who specialize in Parkinson's. We have a nurse practitioner who specializes in Parkinson's disease, and we have two nurses who specialize in Parkinson's disease. And that team together helps to manage the patients in their homes through phone calls and messages and the electronic record, and also manage the patients in the office.
Excellent. Thank you again for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Neil in Milwaukee a chance to chime in here. Neil, thank you for calling. What can we do for you today?
Thanks. I've got a question. I work in the natural resources field, and a lot of us are outside a lot, and I notice a large percent of people I know have Parkinson's disease, and I was wondering if there was a relationship possibly with Lyme disease.
Not specifically Lyme disease. We think that Parkinson's disease is multifactorial, meaning there's more than one thing that increases your risk. We know, for example, that cigarette smokers and coffee drinkers have a low risk of Parkinson's disease. We know that men have a higher risk than women. We know that men who've been people who've been raised in agricultural environment or drunk well water in childhood seem to have a higher risk. And all those kinds of findings lead us to believe that it's kind of a combination of a genetic susceptibility that somehow then is activated by an environmental exposure. And the genes and the exposures might be different from person to person, but the two together seem to then kind of cause this progressive loss of brain cells. And it's interesting that we think that the brain cell loss begins at least 6 years, maybe 10 years, or maybe even longer before the disease is diagnosable.
Interesting. Neil, thank you. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Gregory in Turtle Lake, Wisconsin. Hi, Gregory.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had Parkinson's for about 9 years now, and I've noticed probably the last 2 years, I get fatigued really easy. I'll do a little physical work, say vacuum or try to cut the grass, and I can't do it for more than about 5 or 10 minutes, and I got to lay down and take a nap. And what happens at night, the reason I don't sleep is because I'll sleep for approximately 2 hours, or almost exactly 2 hours, and then I'll wake up, the tremor will wake me up, and sometimes I'll take a Cinemet to get back to sleep, or sometimes I'll just lay there and try to get back to sleep. But I think that's the reason you get so, you never get your deep sleep. you know, like you're supposed to. You just keep waking up with the tremors.
Yeah. You know, Dr. Shannon, is that about right?
Sleep disturbance is almost universal in Parkinson's disease. It can actually start before the disease is diagnosable as well. We think that the kind of circadian rhythm, what is off in Parkinson's disease, we know that the melatonin system that helps to regulate sleep is kind of blunted. So melatonin is the natural chemical that goes up when you're tired and goes up when the sun goes down because it's suppressed by light. And then it goes down when the sun comes up, and that's why we sleep when we sleep. So sometimes it's as simple as taking a melatonin at bedtime to help make your sleep a little bit deeper. But this issue of the symptoms reappearing at night is fairly common. And we often will use a long-acting carbidopa-levodopa at bedtime and then something for sleep, either melatonin or sometimes something a little bit more aggressive for sleep to get people sleeping at night.
Maybe I'll try that. I guess I haven't tried that one yet, so I'll give that a try.
Yeah, it's worth it. Probably talk to your doctor a bit about it, maybe, Dr.
Yes, it's always good to clear even melatonin, which is an over-the-counter preparation. It's always good to clear that with your doctor. You know, and also sleep hygiene is a really important thing. So that means sleeping in a really dark room. The room has to be cool so your body core temperature can go down, which is necessary for sleep. Not having screen time before bed. So there are a lot of other things that people, that everyone should be doing to ensure
right.
their sleep is better. But if you have Parkinson's, which makes it harder to sleep, you should be extra cognizant of having good sleep hygiene.
Yeah. Thanks again for calling, Gregory. I appreciate your call. I want to give Brad in Fenimore a chance to join in the conversation. Brad, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My mother had PSP, and she died of it about 3 years ago. She started having lots of falls and not being able to drive, and eventually she was diagnosed with the supranuclear palsy. And she went to the nursing home in Fenimore, and after about 2 years, she passed away. She passed away 3 years ago. And at the time, there was maybe three or four people there that had that. A while back, about a year ago, I went to see a neurologist for some OCD symptoms. And he asked about my mother, and he said that, and I told him the story. He said that, you know, about eight people die of Parkinson's. PSP a year in Wisconsin. So it's an extremely rare and misdiagnosed condition. And he said sometimes that people Dr. Jones said some people will, just not know what it is. And that's kind of a catch-all term sometimes. I was just kind of wondering, you know, like what are the statistics for how many people get PSP and per year? And is it really high for one nursing home to have three or four? If that's true, that's what I was told when I was there by a nurse. And I was also wondering, my neurologist asked if I would get the autopsy results and give them to him so he could look at them.
Yeah.
Are all people autopsies that get PSP the die of it?
Well, in this country, first of all, I'm very sorry about your loss. It's a difficult thing to watch someone you love go through something as terrible as progressive supranuclear palsy. It's extremely rare, but people with PSP are more likely to need care in a nursing home because their disability is so profound towards the end, and that might explain why there might have been a few in that nursing home. Or maybe there was a doctor who was actually particularly good at diagnosing PSP, or your point, which is that it might not have been an accurate diagnosis. And the question about autopsy is that in this country, we don't get a lot of autopsies on people who've died, especially if they've died from something where the family had an idea that they knew what was the cause. So, and part of it is the feeling that, oh, she's been through so much, or he's been through so much, we don't want to put him through the autopsy. And part of it's just that that's not, in our culture, we don't really value that kind of importance of the autopsy. But it's fairly clear, we make these diagnoses based on clinical symptoms and signs. And in PSP, there's the MRI can have changes that are highly suggestive of PSP. But it's only at autopsy that we know for sure that our diagnosis is right. So we like to encourage people to get autopsies, but it just isn't done very often in this country.
So maybe that's why that doctor wanted to see the results assuming there must have been an autopsy in this case.
Was there an autopsy? Did your mother have an autopsy?
Well, that was just my why I called. I was wondering, well, maybe I should go check to see if there was one because, you know, like my sister's a nurse at the same hospital, and you know, like I would go ask her and see if she would get the autopsy results. But you know, like, do I ask her?
Yeah, sure. And maybe because your sister was a nurse there, maybe she requested an autopsy. You never know.
Usually you will know because the body, then the funeral home picks the body up from the morgue after the autopsy. And usually they will inform you if there's been an autopsy. But it's worth checking.
Sure.
It's worth checking.
Yeah, check it out, Brad. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee next. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry, and hi, guests. I had some questions regarding Huntington's disease. My father died of Huntington's disease. I took care of him through the course of the illness. He had two brothers who also died of the disease. I had myself genetically tested, and I ended up with 38 of the amino acid repetitions on the Huntington's disease, just as I understand it, just short of the formal of the criteria to make a formal diagnosis. I have amazingly been diagnosed with sleep disorders and clinical depression, severe long-term. I have problems with balance and falling. I try to exercise by walking every day, which seems to help. I'm being treated by a neurologist who specializes in sleep disorders. I've seen a variety of neurologists who have told me long ago that symptoms I have might be related to Huntington's disease. That was after I had the initial genetic testing.
Yeah.
Here's my issue. I'm prepared to deal with whatever, but I would like a definitive diagnosis. I can tell you that my cognitive abilities have reduced significantly. Before all this started, I was pretty highly educated, so I have some resources and do things to keep my brain active.
Sure.
Well, here's my bottom line: is there some place where I can go to find out what's really going on? Because I'm having all of these symptoms, and I'm frankly wondering if something isn't being missed. I'm being treated symptomatically, which is somewhat effective.
Yep. What do you think, Dr. Shannon? Should Jim be getting some additional opinions, or what?
So, Jim, your genetic test is in what's called the incompletely penetrant range, which means many people who have those 38 repeats in that part of the genetic code will become sick, although it's a later onset and milder progression than people with above 40 repeats. And it's true that a lot of the cognitive and behavioral symptoms of Huntington's can be misdiagnosed as something else. So the best idea is to go to someone who specializes in Huntington's disease. And in Milwaukee, it would be from the Medical College of Wisconsin, Dr. Karen Blindauer would be the person to see, or someone on her team. Or you could come, if you wanted to come to Madison, you could come to our Huntington's Disease Center of Excellence Clinic. But it's a good idea. You're thinking just the right way, that it's a good idea to get a definitive opinion about whether any of your challenges are related to Huntington's, and if so, whether there's a better treatment for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling, Jim. Appreciate your call. What's new? What are the current treatments out there now? Are there new drugs that show promise for Huntington's?
Well, Huntington's disease, as I mentioned before, since it's one gene and everyone's got the same abnormality, we're very excited that we'll have new treatments. So the way the genetic abnormality works is it's a gene that controls the recipe for a protein, and the protein has the same building block repeated many times, so the genetic code will have the code for that building block. And normal people have about 20 repetitions, and once you get above 40, you have 100% chance of getting Huntington's disease, and in between 36 and 40, you've got a little bit less than 100% chance. So because that protein is kind of the thing that starts the whole degenerative process going, if you can block the gene from making that abnormal protein, you should be able to influence the onset or progression of the disease. And so there's a very exciting therapy by a drug company called Ionis, which blocks the message from the gene to the protein manufacturing machinery.
Wow.
So that if it's given as a spinal tap, given into the spinal fluid, it reduces the amount of protein. And there was a very exciting early clinical trial in a limited number of subjects, less than 50 subjects, that suggested that you could reduce that protein. And that was very exciting for us. But now we need the next 5 or 10 years to really study that drug in people with Huntington's disease and see whether it's really going to turn out to be an effective treatment. And there are other companies kind of devising similar kinds of approaches to what's called gene silencing or reducing the mutant protein levels.
Sounds like that one, though, needs to be applied, used at the very earliest stages. Or can it be used for someone who's a few years into it?
Well, that's always a hard question to answer. In animal models, you can actually genetically engineer models to have the human Huntington protein in there and to have a switch to turn it off. And if you turn off the protein in animals, not only do they not get worse, they also get better, not necessarily 100% better. But there is some evidence, at least in animals, that we could apply it later in the disease. The question then becomes, if a person's got really severe disability, how long do you want to prolong that severe disability? You know, how long? And that's a question for patients and families and how they want to be cared for and how they want to live. But certainly, we think for patients with early disease, and bear in mind now, we have a genetic test for this disease, so you can test everyone at risk, and you can identify those people and start treating them early. So this is an extremely exciting kind of approach that we hope will be very successful, but it's too soon to know.
Yeah, is that one that's covered by insurance often? I suppose it depends on family history, maybe.
So this is an experimental treatment. So
okay.
If it gets approved, then it would be approved by the FDA, and then the insurance companies pretty much have to pay for it.
Yeah, but now, because it's in the research phase, it can be free, or is it small charge or large charge?
No, if it's in a research study, it's free to the patient. But bear in mind that in a research study, you have a comparator, which is usually a placebo.
Yeah.
So not everyone in the research study gets the active treatment, and sometimes they can, at the end, get the active treatment once it's been determined to be effective. Sometimes people can have access to it before it becomes FDA approved, but it does have to go through all this kind of rigorous clinical testing.
Well, certainly lots of people interested in this, Dr. Shannon, and here we are out of time. I want to thank you so much. You'll come back and be with us again. I'd like to do this again with you.
Absolutely, anytime.
Dr. Kathleen Shannon, professor and chair of neurology at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health and the Center for Excellence at the university. Of course, she works in that Center for Excellence. It's great to have her along, and I promise we'll talk about Huntington's and Parkinson's again on the program. We're going to switch gears a little bit, though, and talk with you about medical emergencies at home. And frankly, if you're in a situation with Huntington's or Parkinson's disease, you might want to stay listening, because I imagine there are more often than not medical emergencies that crop up as a result of these and other kinds of diseases. And Dr. Benjamin Schnapp up next from the University of Wisconsin to talk with us about preparing for medical emergencies at home of the type we just kind of talked about, but also other things that happen at home. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.